Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. And you may notice that it's not Sunday when this episode is dropping. That's because we're doing a bonus episode this week. We will be back with our regularly scheduled show on Sunday. But today, I wanted you to hear the wonderful podcast of Aaron Millar. He is the host of Hidden Trails of Oregon. And wow, is he a master of this craft. He will bring you right into the heart of the Oregon experience. You will hear voices from that state. You will hear in this episode, well, let me backtrack and let me talk about this episode for a moment. This episode has to do with a marvelous cultural center that explores the famous Oregon Trail, that explores the story of Lewis and Clark, but does it from the Native American point of view. And as you might imagine, that's a very different point of view for this story. And so he interviews the people who are creating this cultural center. He takes audio from the center, so you hear chanting, you hear storytelling, you hear the people who are deeply involved in bringing this other side of the story to light tell their truth in a very compelling, really visceral way. And I gotta say, it brings Oregon stories to light in ways you probably haven't heard before, because this state is far more diverse than most people know. He has another wonderful episode about going to a rodeo in Oregon. Who knew? I mean, I've been to Oregon many times. I love it. I always end up hiking because you get some peer pressure in Oregon if you don't hike. I feel like you walk around the streets of Portland and everybody looks like they're in their adventure gear, because they probably are, because it's so easy to get out into nature. Or if hiking's not your jam, the fabulous wineries of the Willamette Valley are so fun to visit. Best Pinot Noir on the planet, hands down. Plus sake factories, there are breweries to explore. Just so much fun in the Willamette Valley. Portland itself is a wonder, with extraordinary museums, with a great food scene, with lots of cultural attractions, from live theater to one of the best live music scenes in the United States. So if you haven't been to Oregon, boy, are you missing out. And you will find that when you listen to this wonderful series. Once again, it's called Hidden Trails of Oregon, and it's available wherever podcasts can be streamed. So like the Fromer Travel Show, you'll hear it on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on many other places. So let me stop gabbing and let me turn this over to Aaron Millar, who has a really wonderful, surprising tale to share with you. Okay, let's run the tape.
From wild coasts and volcanic peaks to lush vineyards and streets bursting with creativity, join me on the Hidden Trails of Oregon. We're going behind the travel veil to those secret places only locals know. In Oregon, the extraordinary is ordinary. and the adventure is about to begin. This week, we're in Eastern Oregon, just outside of Pendleton, home of the world-famous Roundup. We're sitting down with an expert in indigenous knowledge and history of the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla people, and exploring a place that details 16,000 years of Native history and the untold side of the most famous emigrant trail in America. These tribes welcomed their earliest visitors with open arms, and despite everything, they continue to do so today.
Ah, from Yanawi. Shna nami ticham and the kui winiksha imatalam and the ku nami naimuma kashpoa kayus imatella walla walla.
You have just entered into the homeland of the Umatillas, the Cayuses, and Walla Wallas.
My Indian name is Sisawipum. That's in the language of my grandmother, who was Columbia River Indian from the area called Wayam. She gave me that name when I was 13, and then about 26 years ago, I became the director of Temescal Cultural Institute, where I still work.
And that's where we are today, enjoying a bright morning on the rolling prairie with Bobby Connor.
So, as a kid, I grew up here, right in these fields, and now we have this multi-million dollar world-class museum, and it's in my homeland, and our Cayuse, Umatilla, Walla Walla people's tribal headquarters is right here on the Umatilla Reservation. And Temescal was built with three purposes in mind. One, to accurately depict the history and culture of the Cayuse and Umatilla and Walla Walla peoples, because everything you learned in elementary school, high school, college is wrong.
Not every tribe is the same. We have different languages, different songs, different customs. The settling of the West, as it has been called, is the unsettling of the West for our people. Most of what has been written about our people is in the context of war. But most of you have not heard our perspective.
The stories and histories you will hear from our tribal members and our elders are their own words.
The other two reasons this museum was founded was to contribute to the tribal economy. We were a once quite wealthy people, and after the period of the exploration and the trappers and traders from Europe and America, and then the American missionaries, and then the government takeover of our lands, we became a group of people confined to a small footprint compared to our vast homeland. So that tribal economy became a subsistence economy, survival economy. But the third reason, besides contributing to the tribal economy, was that we wanted to perpetuate the technologies and knowledges of our people. We've lived in this land for more than 16,000 years. We want to live here forever because we've been here for all of our history. In order to perpetuate that knowledge and technology, we've do scholarship and research. We've published our own tribal history book. We've published a Native Place Names Atlas that shows before Lewis and Clark came and started renaming things, they all had names. Those names are important for our tribal sovereignty because they are evidence that this is our homeland. The names are a database embedded with information that you won't have from the names of Lewis and Clark and Thompson and Pendleton.
The tale of Lewis and Clark's expedition and the Oregon Trail that followed in their footsteps is very well known. What isn't is the other side of that story, the Native side, one of betrayal, war, displacement, and eventually slow reclamation. Bobby has worked tirelessly with her confederated tribe to tell that history, but it wasn't easy. In 1993, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation proposed a center to tell the story of the Oregon Trail from a Native American perspective. But they were told there was no budget for Indian interpretive centers, although that same year, more than $500,000 was allocated to another Oregon Trail museum. So on August 12th, a wagon train celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Oregon Trail was stopped by natives on horseback at the border of the Umatilla Reservation. One rider was Anton Minthorn, chairman of his tribal council, and he spoke in protest, describing the challenges faced by his people of poverty and unemployment, but also of his vision for a place of learning and research for all people, forever, for a different perspective on Manifest Destiny. And it worked. Within a year, funding was secured, and on July 31st, 1998, the Tomas Slicht Cultural Institute opened its doors.
One of our elders, who helped shape the exhibits, came up with the term Tamaslik. It means to turn. So if you turn over a word into another language, that would be interpret. So not only are we interpreting our history, but we're turning the story around.
The earth and myself are of one mind, said young Chief Joseph. And that's where our journey through the Institute begins, with how the natural universe shaped the existence of the people.
It would take me 3 days to tell you that story, but we were created here. We've always been here. When this world was created, it was the water that was created first. When the water was created, it spoke a promise. I am going to take care of the Indian people. I am going to give life to everything. And then the land was created, and the land spoke a promise. I am going to take care of the Indian people from the day they are born till the day they die. And these are the foods that are going to take care of them.
Before this became a patchwork quilt of wheat land and further on peas and other crops, this would have been a vast grazing land with pothole marshes, rich for the migratory flyway north and south. Tules and cattails grow in those marshes, and we covered our lodges with them. The teepee poles for the tule mat lodges that we erect are just up here in the foothills. If you go a half an hour up into the mountains past the timber line, you will be at the summit about 4,600 feet, and you can harvest other foods at that elevation. So our homeland is alpine furs and alpine foods and alpine wildlife all the way to sea level.
The people follow the seasons with their food sources, but winter was for village life, where valleys and water waves gave protection from harsh weather. And every midwinter, villages would come alive with song, dances, and feasts.
They're singing about the land of light, the light that comes from inside of us, the light that comes from inside the earth, the light that lives on the other side of the veil where our elders go when they pass away. And those songs are talking about the promise of our future. And they're talking about the prayers for the foods that we consume and the species we live with. So when our people say that we're praying for the landscape and the land feels our footsteps when we dance, it hears our prayers when we sing, it hears the drum beats, it's true.
But songs weren't just prayers. They were also how the people kept their history and culture alive from generation to generation.
There is one song that Grandma sang for us one time, that your days are counted in your life, and you have to be accountable for each day that you live. But she recorded these songs for preservation purposes, and she gave us these songs to listen to remind us of our religion and of our lives and how we live them. Because she said, you know, you want to live your life right, otherwise you won't see me again. People have a Bible that they, you know, use to read. Well, we have songs, and you just sing that and carry it on.
The people believed that every living being was a story, and every storytelling was a time for learning. From childhood up, their oral traditions helped them understand the entire world around them, a world that was much more interconnected than outsiders thought.
We traded with the people from the other side of the big mountains. We traded with people who came from the ocean, the Great Basin, and what's now known as California, British Columbia, and Alberta. People may not be aware of it, but right there on the Columbia River in Oregon, as well as across the river in Washington, is Celilo. And it's a place where the most magnificent waterfall in the West and the richest salmon fishery for more than 10,000 years was. It's now inundated under what's Lake Celilo behind the Dalles Dam, which is a hydroelectric dam. But when you stand at Celilo Park and imagine a series of falls, iconic, more grand than Niagara Falls, you can imagine that people came from thousands of miles away because it was one of the six or seven great North American continental trade centers for indigenous people here. And so we live in a place that was kind of a crossroads of history for a very long time, even before Europeans came.
The key to this network was the acquisition of the horse. Oral tradition says local tribes traded for them with the Shoshone. And in the early 1800s, at the peak of the people's power in this area, some families would have herds in the thousands. But not long after the arrival of the horse, spiritual leaders began warning of great change, and visions became reality as foreigners and foreign disease arrived. Some of the first outsiders to settle in Oregon were missionaries that brought gospel and, in their minds, civilization to indigenous peoples. But differing Christian groups competed to control conversion and their vision for the future of the wandering Indians, as they called them.
You have said the whites are like the wind. You cannot stop them.
Old Chief Joseph once said, "We do not want churches. They will teach us to quarrel about God, as the Catholics and Protestants do. We may quarrel with men sometimes about things on this earth, but we never quarrel about God. We do not want to learn that." Soon the people became disenchanted with missionaries, seeing them as normal men and women with human weaknesses. And so they started to push back, resulting in many wars and eventually hundreds of treaties that recognized tribal sovereignty, but at a cost. Huge amounts of land had to be given away.
Our people ceded more than 6 million acres to the United States government and were moved onto a reservation.
And so the process of assimilation had begun.
St. Andrews was established in 1847. Parochial schools are strict. There's no fooling around about their instructions. You have to learn it.
We used to get up 4 o'clock in the morning, go out and drill. Now they used to call us the CBB, the Catholic Boys Brigade. We did everything by the bugle.
Boarding schools were created to drain indigenous lifestyles from tribal kids. They were fiercely punished for speaking their own languages or wearing their own clothes.
We always got punished, and I always try to forget those times because it makes you feel bad. But I think that molded us to accept all the disappointments that we had later on in life.
For breakfast, well, twice a week, we'd have cornmeal mush. And there'd be big worms in that mush, and if you didn't set that damn worm aside and eat that mush, you didn't get any more. That was it.
If you talked Indian in Chamawa, you got whipped for it. Many times I got whipped, spread eagle on a table with a rubber hose, and I didn't know what I was getting whipped for.
But nothing could stop students from maintaining the old ways.
We would steal away the creek there. There'd be a lot of wild horses up there. We'd catch them, we'd have our own fletching, arrow fletching, we'd make arrows, make our own bows, and we'd kill game with what we had. So we could stay out any length of time until bed check when they played taps, and we'd sneak in. "We are the boys from CBB, rough and tough, hard to bluff."
Don't take anything for granted. The land, the water, the elders, the songs, the traditions. If we lose those things, we lose who we are.
In my generation, when I was in elementary school, there were five kids on the bus who spoke their language as this, our tribal language, as a first language. And all of those people are revered elders now because they are an encyclopedia, each of them. Their lives are like encyclopedias to us.
As the process of assimilation tried to stamp out native language and culture, the creatures and land native people had stewarded for thousands of years suffered with them.
The Columbia River and all of its tributaries were once teeming with fish and provided our people with one of their main sources of food.
Salmon are anadromous. This means that they are born in the river, they travel downstream to the ocean to mature, and then they swim back upstream to the place where they were born, to spawn and to die. The dams created obstacles for the salmon. All other river life was also affected.
The Grand Ronde doesn't have the fish it used to have. For 70 years, the Umatilla River had no Chinook runs.
After the dams, the river changed fast and dramatically.
We're still hunters, we're still fishermen, we still dig our roots, we still pick the berries, we still live on the foods that the Creator gave us a very, 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 very long time ago. We want our young people to be able to do and to know what our ancestors knew. So for our people to be strong here, it's been necessary for us to get water back in the river, spring and fall Chinook salmon back in the rivers, which we've done over the last 42 years.
The Confederated Tribes took action, sponsoring programs that restore natural migration and improving habitats and water quality.
Yeah, my mother used to tell me that.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.